Surprise! It's me, Philip, and this is the Bear Den, where we talk about bears, wildlife, and people making a difference for them. Depending on when you're listening to this, we wrapped up our season a few weeks ago, but we have a special bonus episode, as this only came together, really, also a few weeks ago. And I didn't really want to sit on it, I did want to get it out there. We're welcoming Gloria Dickey, freelance journalist and author of the book Eight Bears, Into the Bear Den, and we discuss conservation and her global journey researching the world's eight remaining bear species. So what have we got coming up? Gloria talks about her background, a bit about her writing process, and, you know, some of the challenges like witnessing Asiatic black bears on bile farms, as well as positive experiences visiting China to learn about panda conservation and panda diplomacy. We also talk about the future of threatened bear species, particularly those impacted by climate change, and some current bear-related news, Japan, and conservation challenges in Alaska. So we cover a lot, and I hope you enjoy the chat as much as I did, and are inspired to check out the book and her other work. So, without further ado... There is a place in the remote northwoods of Minnesota, North America. It's located near the town of Orr, population approximately 300. Outside of this town is an area where normal rules are put to one side. It's a place where humans and wildlife meet. It's a special place, wholly unique and not without its controversies. This is the Vinschuti Wildlife Sanctuary, run by the American Bear Association, ABA for short. The ABA is dedicated to promoting a better understanding of black bears and all wildlife through education, observation, and experience. I'm your host, Philip Stubley, and welcome to the Bear Den. Well, I mean, obviously I've been talking to people about bears across the podcast and hearing from people all over the world. And now we've got your lovely self on, and you've kind of gone further than that. You've actually been to all these places and met the people in person. So, Gloria, it's really great to have you here today. So could you introduce yourself and just tell us where you're speaking to us from?
Sure. I'm Gloria Dickey. I'm a freelance journalist and author of the book Eight Bears. And I'm currently based in Bangkok, which is a bit of a departure from my usual terrain, but I've been here for the past year kind of reporting on conservation issues in Southeast Asia.
Oh, amazing. I mean, yeah, there's plenty of material, I suppose, to write about there. So, but yeah, you're a bit of a jet setter, really. So you're based in Bangkok for the foreseeable, basically.
For the foreseeable, yeah, probably for at least another year. I mean, there are bears here, which is good. We've got sun bears and Asiatic black bears, so I think not completely a departure from my usual reporting beats, but we were just talking about, yeah, the heat, the humidity, the mosquitoes can be a bit of a cross to bear, pun intended.
I know, yeah. I know. I mean, I was quite lucky. I think whenever I've been in Asia, they don't seem to like me that much. It's one of those where I'll be sitting there and I'll be sitting next to someone and they're getting kind of just eaten alive.
Yeah, I'm the target. Like, I'm the target.
All right. So, okay, I know who to sit next to then. So have you always wanted to be a writer, like a journalist? Like I've always found writing's a bit of a compulsion, so it's something you can't help. It's kind of a bit of a need there. So I just wondered like where it's coming from for you.
As a kid, I wanted to be a veterinarian. And then I think when I was a bit older, I kind of realized that I like wildlife or wild animals more than just domestic animals. And I remember looking into like what it would take to be a wildlife biologist. And my forte was not math or like physics or chemistry. Like that was kind of at school, I despised those classes. I really enjoyed writing, English, languages, geography too. So I was a little bit dismayed, I think, at that time of like, oh, like I'm not really good at what it would take to be perhaps a wildlife biologist, at least to get through school for it, and, you know, chemistry and physics and all of that. But at the time I was reading a lot of National Geographic articles about wildlife biologists. And I remember having this moment where I was like, oh, like someone has to write these articles. And then I was kind of thinking like, okay, like maybe some sort of like, I mean, like a lot of kids, I was like, okay, I could work for National Geographic was kind of the initial fever dream. But yeah, I think from that moment onwards, I kind of wanted to be an environmental journalist in whatever form that would go on to take.
That's right. And I mean, I think, well, you've lived that dream out, right? You've written for National Geographic, haven't you?
Yeah. I have, and I'm a National Geographic explorer as well for sloth bears in India.
Oh, amazing. And so, like, do you have a writing routine particularly? Is there sort of like, you know, you've got a set sort of thing you have to do or a kind of process?
It varies. I'd say too, like my career has been fairly dynamic in the sense of like I write in a lot of different formats. So I've written a book, which is obviously quite long. I've written magazine features, I've written newspaper stories, I've written for wire services, which is like, 300 words or less. So I think throughout, like I've been a journalist now for about 12 years, and like all of my works kind of come in different iterations, which makes it a little bit hard, I think, to like establish a pattern. I think, fiction writers can have their kind of set writing routines. I think for me, kind of my only principles are normally that I write early in the morning, if I can. Like my brain is so much better at 6 a.m. than it is at 2 p.m. And ideally, I also have coffee. So those are
Yeah,
kind of
always
my two
helps.
things in terms of where I write. I typically would always like to work from cafes to get write most things. I like to be around people when I'm working, not like library, quiet solitude. But in Bangkok, I actually write from home a lot more. I've kind of gotten into like the double screens, double laptop things. So it's so much easier when I'm looking at like a lot of notes and scientific studies and interviews. Like it makes me a little bit more predisposed to staying at home,
Yeah, no,
which
I'm.
maybe is a bad thing.
No, I'm a victim of the double screen boom as well. I'm just like I struggle if I've got one nowadays. But
Yeah, when I
well,
wrote Eight Bears, I did it all on my laptop. And now I look back and I'm like, I don't know how I wrote a book on my laptop, but there we go.
I mean people did it on typewriters and things before, you know.
That's
So
true. They wrote pen and paper too.
yeah. But all right, okay. So I don't know why you just made me think of it as Hemingway when you were talking about writing in the morning, because that was kind of his thing, wasn't it? Like write till midday, then hit up the bar.
That sounds like the journalist lifestyle. But
Yeah.
yeah, I mean, I love working for myself in part just because you can kind of work in the rhythms of when your brain works the most, versus like having to subscribe to 9 to 5 or 9 to 6. It's like, okay, if I know that I work best starting my day at 6 or 7 a.m., I can kind of do more of that.
Yeah. I guess sometimes I suppose inspiration can hit it at any time, so you might just kind of end up scribbling away on whatever's nearest notepad or whatever.
Yeah, I find too, like if I'm going out, I used to always go for walks. Like whenever I have a big story to think about a process, going for like a long walk will really kind of like start to shape how I want to frame it and structure it in my head. So that was always like a writing advice that I would often give to people too, is like if you're struggling with something, like go for a walk to work through it.
Think, yeah, it's like the sort of I would always do the thing where if you're struggling with something, put it in a drawer, throw it to one side for a while, walk away, yeah, and then come back to it. I think that's always helpful. Yeah. So yeah, what about bears? So how did the sort of association with bears come from? Have you always been interested in bears? I know you said you want to be like wildlife biologists, so I'm guessing it stemmed from childhood.
I mean, I always liked wildlife. I don't remember like the particular moment where I kind of was like, bears are it, bears are my thing. I have some kind of like nascent early childhood experiences. I did not grow up with like a favorite teddy bear. My brother did. I had cats and a bunny, so I did not have like a teddy bear association that I read about in my book. I think one of my earliest memories, though, was that, and I wrote about this briefly in my book too, was that we used to go to the Canadian Rockies when I was a kid, because my grandparents lived near there. And my mom was extremely afraid of grizzly bears. And so she would put me on this like little like leash whenever we were going on like the trails or anything around, the camp, because she was so afraid that a bear would come and grab me. And my brother was allowed to kind of go ahead and, do what he wanted. And I remember being very frustrated that I was kind of tethered, and I couldn't run off into the woods to look for animals. So I kind of said, it's kind of parental irony, of course, that you end up with a kid who's like, well, now that I'm an adult, I'm gonna chase the bears around the world.
Well, yeah, you're off the
But for me,
leash
it
now.
really, I'm off the leash. I'm off the leash is my form of rebellion. And then, yeah, like where I grew up in kind of southwestern Ontario of Canada, we didn't have bears there. So I think for me, they used to be there. They're in a lot of the US, obviously. They're kind of all around where I grew up, but we were kind of in this like bear desert. And I think that lack of kind of, apex predator, that lack of like big charismatic megafauna made me all the more captivated by bears. And then when I was 23, I moved to Colorado, Boulder, Colorado, which is in the foothills of the Rockies, and there were lots of bears coming to town. And so my first kind of encounters was with those bears that would come into the city and that were sleeping in trees and eating apples, and that kind of led into my oops, that led into
Oh,
my
sorry.
master's project.
Yeah. I feel parallels with myself slightly because, like, when you talk about, because obviously in the UK we don't have bears, so you know. And then when I went to Canada, so I lived in Whistler, Vancouver, and then I also went to the Canadian Rockies. That's kind of where the kind of fascination with bears grew from there, for me as well. But that's so
Yeah,
cool.
I think you engage with nature in like such a different way when you are in a place where you know there are bears. Like your mind just takes on its own wilderness in a way. Like I feel like you're kind of like, wow, like I could see a bear here. I think I'm just saying I just got back from a trip to Alaska. And there were so many parts of it up in the north. I'm like, oh, it reminds me of Iceland. I was like, oh, this looks, you know, out on the tundra. You're like, okay, this could be Iceland. I'm like, but there could also be a grizzly bear. So like your mind just kind of goes in a different place. And actually we were down sitting by a stream one day, having lunch, doing some field work. And then when we, and I remember thinking briefly like this, you know, seems like good bear habitat along the stream with the willows. And then we were just leaving about 20 minutes later, someone saw a grizzly bear on the other side of the slope. So it's like you were kind of in bear habitat, in bear country right there. But it feels so calm and normal when you're, you know, it could be any place in the world, then there's bears.
Yeah, it's always possibilities. So yeah, I thought, like, let's talk about Eight Bears then. You've mentioned it. Eight Bears, Mythic Past and Peril Future. It's the book you wrote. So, like, what's the 25 words or less kind of pitch? What's it about?
Oh, it is a journey around the world to look at our relationships to and the threats facing the world's eight remaining species of bears. So from polar bears in the Arctic to spectacled bears in the Andes to sun and moon bears in Southeast Asia.
And so, like, what was I mean, obviously, yes, we've just talked about how great bears are, but what was kind of the main inspiration for writing Eight Bears? Like, what got to a point when you went, I want to write a novel on this, not a novel, but a book on this?
I was doing a lot of work on American black bears and grizzly bears in Yellowstone. This was kind of the mid-2010s. I was doing a lot of reporting on these topics. The Yellowstone grizzly bear was up for delisting, which it often is.
It
I was
still is,
thinking of
isn't
funding
it?
the, I think it still is again. It's always kind of going like back and forth, the political debate. I was doing some writing on polar bears. And I think one day I just, this is like my recollection, which could be wrong, but I just Googled like how many bears are there, because I didn't know how many bears existed. And I think I was just like, how many bears? And Google came, I was like, eight bears. And I was like, oh, like that's like a pretty good number for a book. Like that's, you know, eight clean chapters if you had eight bears compared to some other unwieldy species where there's hundreds of something, right? And then yeah, so that was kind of like the first moment that I thought about it. At the same time, too, I kind of wanted to do more pretty early in my career. I had an interest in working internationally. Wanted to get out in the world more beyond just, you know, Canada and the US where I'd grown up. And I was like, okay, well, these bears are also like located in some pretty interesting places to go to. If you were to do a book, right? You could go to the Andes, you could go to Vietnam, you could go to China, you could go to India, right? So it was kind of like appealed to my kind of youthful naivete and, you know, wanting to get more international experience with a very doable number of bears. So it's kind of from like a practical standpoint in some ways, in addition to like my interest in what I knew of the North American species. And I think to remember thinking like there were so many books that had been written about grizzly bears and about polar bears and black bears, and there was almost nothing that had been written about the other bear species in for a North American audience. So yeah, I kind of was like, I'd like to introduce people to the spectacled bear, to the sun bear, to the sloth bear. I think people would be interested in hearing more about those animals.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right about stuff like the sloth bear, sun bear. It feels like there's so much that we don't know about them still. It's always fascinating to read about them, I think. So, how long did it take to put the book together then? Once you decided you were going to do it, and like, kind of, I guess, I mean, obviously, you've got to travel all these places and organize that. I imagine it didn't just happen overnight.
Yeah, so essentially, like the very first kind of like, oh, this could actually happen moment was that I went to a conference for environmental journalists in the US in the fall of 2017. And they had like a little session where you had like 2 minutes to kind of like roughly pitch a book idea. And they'd assembled this panel of editors who would come and they would give you feedback. You know, it's kind of just like they would just give you feedback if you were interested maybe in writing a book. And so I stood up, I gave my little like eight bear pitch. And one of the editors there, Matt Weiland at WW Norton, he came out to me after. And he's like, oh, I actually really like your idea. Like, I'd encourage you to get an agent and put together a full proposal to like and then bring it to me. So that took me about a year to write a proposal, maybe a bit less than that, 6 months. So got an agent, which also takes some time. And then when the book went to auction, I ended up choosing to go with Matt because I really liked, we had the same vision. He had a very eloquent approach to the book. I was very happy with that choice in the end. And then from there, it was like about 5 years total. So it's a very long undertaking. I spent 2018 and 2019 fully reporting the book, traveling, living in a backpack. 2020, luckily the pandemic hit, so I could write during that time uninterrupted. Into 2021, and then the final 2 years before it came out in the summer of 23 were like fact checking, marketing, more research, kind of tying things together for the release. So all in, I would say like 2017 to 2023 was kind of the saga that the book spanned.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting to hear the process, just like what goes into it. And I mean, well, it was as far as I can tell by reading the cover, it's been very well received. And well, best book of the year in the New Yorker Economist. I mean, was the reception a bit of a pleasant surprise?
It was, yeah. I mean, I think like you don't know. I mean, books are so difficult, right? Like, especially like nonfiction, especially like environmental nonfiction can be really difficult. It's a very small corner of the market. I think what I really loved about the publishing process was just like hearing from so many readers. My dad likes to check my like Goodreads reviews every week and tell me like what people are saying. And like, it's actually quite nice to like, some people have left like nice comments about how they relate to the book. They've shared their own stories with theirs. So that's kind of been like the gift that keeps on giving, is like still hearing from people like every week about what they enjoy. And yeah, of course, like the kind of other merits of acclaim and media coverage is nice too. But eventually that kind of peters off after the first few months, and then what you continue to have is the readers getting in touch. So
I mean, yeah, it is a. I think it took me a day or two to read it. It's very engrossing. It's very accessible. I think it does transcend like kind of like the niche. I think it does reach a nice wider audience. The balance is there nicely. And I've a few friends of mine who are also bear people have enjoyed it. And I remember I did say that we were chatting, and so one of my friend Madison, she's like, "I've got a couple of questions," so I might pepper
okay.
them throughout.
Okay, great.
So your work kind of focuses on climate change a lot, and so being from Canada, and in the book, you sort of said that polar bears are your favorite. And so was that one of the best experiences whilst researching for it?
Yeah, I'd say too, like, I mean, polar bears were, I guess, the bear species that I was able to get the closest to in the wild. I always kind of couch that because I'm like, it was in the wild. I was in one of those like tundra buggy research vessels on the tundra. So you're kind of protected. And it's kind of like you're in the cage in a way, I guess. Like the bear is free, but you feel like you're behind a wall in some way. I mean, you're not behind a wall, but you're like 10 feet off the ground. So you might as well be. But yeah, I think like that was really memorable. I think seeing these animals that spend so much of their life, out on the sea ice, far apart from the human world, just knowing what it takes to survive in that environment and seeing them kind of grace us with their presence on land for a few months each year was really powerful. And knowing, their trajectory, knowing what's happening to these bears, that population in Western Hudson Bay has fallen by roughly half since the 1980s. So to see these animals that seem so strong and powerful in front of you, and knowing kind of how easily humans have laid waste to them through altering their habitat, was quite, yeah, sad and profound.
I imagine. I mean, building on that, when you say I mean, I know there were some dicey moments to say, like South America, or it seemed like in Vietnam as well, there were just some kind of, hot under the collar times. But like, were there like harder bears to research than that?
Yes, certainly I would say the Asiatic black bears that are kept on file farms in much of Southeast Asia and China. I didn't report on this in China. It's very difficult to on this topic. I did go to Vietnam, which in many ways is a success story of bear bile farming. So for those who don't know, many bear species are subject to poaching or farming for the bile that's in their gallbladder, used in traditional Asian medicines. And this has been going on for millennia. But it still persists to this day on kind of these commercial farms in China and kind of smaller like mom and pop farms in places like Vietnam. Vietnam has actually worked very hard to outlaw bear bile farming, and most of those bears have been moved into sanctuaries in recent years. There's still maybe, I guess, around 100 at this point. I'd have to check the numbers, but at the time that I went, I think there was a few hundred that were still on farms. And it was kind of a surreal experience to be in the middle of, a Vietnamese town, and you're walking down the street and there's just like 30 captive moon bears, to your left, right? Like, it's a very strange thing to see. The bears that I saw exhibited a lot of upsetting stress behaviors. They're kind of swaying their heads to and fro, they're pacing, they can barely move in their cages, they have a lot of wounds. The farmers knock them out with ketamine to take their bile. So, I mean, yeah, that was a really hard thing to see up front. And personal, I would think about those bears quite a bit after I'd witnessed what was happening. But at the same time, I also was able to go to some sanctuaries where a lot of these bears have been rescued. And, it was a really beautiful juxtaposition to what I'd seen in these villages, which was, hundreds of bears that are happy. They'd be swinging their hammocks, they'd be swimming, they'd have their bear friends. A lot of them were amputees. They'd lost their paws to claw traps when they were poached from the wild. But a lot of them had a very sweet disposition, and yeah, it was a nice way to kind of see what was possible for these bears.
No, you're right. I mean, it's that kind of like, whenever you see sort of an animal that's a wild animal that just doesn't look right, and you see them in a situation like that, and it's like the individual is just kind of, it's seen as a commodity. It's just it's always hard to, but that's kind of, it's the different perceptions, I suppose, of people. Like people there in certain countries, like they don't see it like we do, or it's a sort of a hard line to navigate, I think.
I remember like my mom was really upset when she kind of read about the bile bears and we talked about it. And I was kind of like, well, it was upsetting, obviously, but I'm also like, well, in Western cultures, we do keep factory farm animals in very similar conditions, right? I think for me, like the bear is upsetting because it lives for so long. Some of these bears have been there for 10 or 15 years, compared to pigs or cows. But at the same time, like the conditions can be very bad for them as well. So it's kind of easy to be like, oh, this is such a barbaric thing to do, but we do subject a lot of animals to this kind of fate.
No, very true. I mean, I'm not a big fan of factory farming. I know what you're
I
saying.
think it's strange to see. I mean, it's strange to see such a powerful, like, it's strange to see bears, it's strange to see tigers, it's strange to see these, like, kind of like monarchs of the wilderness in such conditions. Like, that's what I find, like, really confronting often is when you go, I've been to zoos and these sorts of places too. But to see these very regal animals kind of brought down to, like, this, inhuman existence is quite darkly memorable.
Yeah, it stays with you. And I suppose, well, on a more positive note, what was like the fun side of researching the book there?
Well, researching the book in general, yes, there was a lot of fun. I mean, I think it was very much this dance between like light and dark topics, and I think that's kind of in general like the biodiversity beat for a journalist too, is like there's a lot of gloom, but also there's a lot of like spectacular things in the natural world that hopefully we can kind of still hold on to some of that wonder. For me, like I loved being in China. I loved seeing the pandas, seeing all of the conservation efforts that China had put into protecting pandas. They're building this like giant national park. I actually just visited Chengdu again recently as a tourist, and like it's just so phenomenal to see like how much the social cachet of pandas, right? Like everything is panda. It's very cool to see a bear get that much attention. And yeah, I mean, pandas are fun. They're very cute animals. Can kind of stand and watch them for hours. So yeah, that was definitely a really joyful part of the book. To report that. I mean, oftentimes maybe the bear story itself was a bit sad, but at the same time, you were going to like really beautiful places. I mean, going to the Andes, going to the cloud forests, that really stayed with me. The sheer beauty of that ecosystem, the hummingbirds, the plants, the bromeliads, like it was such a rich place to be. So yeah, I had a lot of fun with that. And also like the scientists, I mean, the people that I went with were so passionate. Many of them had dedicated their lives to these animals. So even I think when you were confronted with these dark stories and narratives. Like there was always a person who was spending their life trying to make a difference.
Yeah. No, that's and that is important. That's why it helps me sleep at night thinking that there's people out there. Everyone's got their sort of interest and passion, and they're all pursuing it. And I like to think that there's someone out there doing that work. But yeah, speaking of China, so a big theme of the book was like the changing relationship between humans and bears. And I was kind of interested to actually ask you a bit more about their experience in China with pandas, because I kind of liked following the changing relationship there, and you really like beautifully described the history there. Like I was really, I mean, I actually ended up getting a copy of The Lady and the Panda, which is a book you reference in there, because
Yes,
about Ruth
I
Harkness. Yeah.
love that
Yeah. So just for anyone listening, she was the first American explorer to bring back a panda to the US, which obviously probably, probably a bit problematic saying it like that these days, but it's a fascinating book. I haven't actually read it yet, but it's sitting
Mm,
on the
okay.
shelf ready to go. I'm really looking forward to it.
There was another book too that came out last year that I reviewed, for foreign policy called The Beast in the Clouds. And I'm not sure if you've come across that one, but it
Oh,
was about
no.
the Roosevelt brothers. The Roosevelt brothers who preceded Ruth Harkness. So it was their first expedition to find a panda. They killed the panda. But it was really interesting to read about kind of like the legacy of that experience and how it impacted like the Roosevelt family's like perception of hunting and like conservation. Set as kind of an adventure narrative like in Sichuan, but I think that was a really good one to read to
Oh.
complement The Lady and the Panda if you're of
Oh.
interest for more bear
Oh,
books.
definitely.
I love that book and I think it would be a great film. I'd love
All
to see a
right.
movie made about that story. But anyway.
Anyone listening, I think Gloria can probably adapt it. There you go. Well, Roosevelt, they are like they're obviously renowned adventurers as well. There's the have you read the or was it The River of Doubt? It's the one about when Roosevelt goes down the River
No.
of Doubt in South America. Yeah, that one's quite a read.
Okay.
I'd recommend that.
Okay. Add it to the list.
Yeah, but one thing you talk about as well, panda diplomacy, I find really fascinating, and I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things I think to write about too, just because I'm generally most drawn to stories that are kind of like at that intersection of like environment and geopolitics. And I think panda diplomacy like really hits that sweet spot where you can kind of talk about like inter country relations alongside conservation. So yeah, essentially pandas kind of became this phenom in the 1930s into the 1940s. China eventually banned the export of all pandas. They're the only country that has pandas, so they can easily have a monopoly on panda production. And then around the 1960s with Richard Nixon, we began to see this trend emerge of pandas kind of being given as gifts to establish Guanxi, which was kind of like goodwill, friendship, envoy culture. And then eventually that's kind of gone through several iterations, from kind of this, pretty purely goodwill token of appreciation, of nation building, of friendship building, into much more of a diplomatic tool, I would say. So China will often give out pandas to countries that they're having good relations with, that they're striking trade deals with. And if countries fall out of favor with China, they might demand that those countries' zoos return their pandas back to China. And so, yeah, there was kind of a time, I think, in the last 5 years where people thought maybe it's the end of panda diplomacy. China, post-COVID, there was a lot of fractured relations there. China was demanding that a lot of bears be returned to China. But then in the past few years, we've seen more and more pandas getting sent out again. So it seems like it's very well alive and good.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for that. And obviously, people can read more about it in the chapter on pandas there, where you also talk about meeting Papa Panda, which I just wanted to ask what that was like.
I never actually met him. I interviewed him. So I will say, like, when I was in China, I mean, a lot of it was just simply as a tourist looking at like the panda infrastructure, so to speak. Very difficult to speak with the Chinese on this topic. So it took me close to a year to go through several friends and friends of friends and people who knew people until I got the opportunity to meet with or to speak with the scientist who was in charge of kind of China's breeding programs of pandas over many decades. But yeah, I mean, he had a very good sense of humor. He had a really interesting historical, account of what has happened in China. I think only a few journalists have ever spoken with him. So that was kind of a special achievement in that sense. And I think it really brought this narrative together as well.
Yeah, I think that was probably my favorite chapter of the book.
It was my favorite to write. And I think like this is the thing too. Like you can have a favorite bear, you can have, you know, I was like, I had the most fun with the panda chapter. And I think like that comes across also
I
because
think
it
so,
was
yeah.
perhaps the least depressing in some ways
Yeah.
too, right? Like, yeah, it was a really enjoyable chapter to write. I had a great time. In Sichuan, I think China kind of subverted a lot of the expectations that I had growing up in the West and being exposed to certain narratives about China, like going there and seeing this really fascinating country with a really rich with a wealth of wilderness that, you know, was any unlike anything that I had seen before.
Yeah, I suppose on the flip side, it's obviously not a criticism particularly, because I think you've already told me that there were extenuating circumstances, but obviously there wasn't enough on sun bears, which speaking of favorite bears.
Yes. I mean, so we had talked about the fact that I was hoping to go to Borneo during 2020, and obviously the world shut down. So kind of my exposure to sun bears was through what I'd seen in the rescue centers in Vietnam. And so kind of having to incorporate, I mean, they're also subject to bile farming as well. But yeah, sun bears, I really wish I could have done a little bit more on.
Oh well, I
It was
suppose.
like 7.5 bears in the
That's,
end, but you know.
well, I guess it's an excuse to do like an updated version in a couple of years' time.
At least a few features, at least now, especially now that I'm in Southeast Asia, I'm like, okay, I have to get out to some sun bear places.
Yeah, I've got a few places you could go, so I'm happy to sort of put you in touch with anywhere. And obviously,
Yes,
oh
that would be
yeah,
great.
keep it in
Future
mind. Yeah,
collab.
definitely. So what is it about bears you think that keeps us interested?
I think there's a lot. I think so much of it is the bear's kind of curiosity and intelligence and likeness to ourselves. I find it endlessly amazing how many places and cultures have stories of bears being human. I mean, I was just at the Museum of the North in Fairbanks, Alaska, and there's all this poetry. I mean, I'm familiar with the fact that people think of polar bears as shapeshifters as well, and Nanook, and but just all this art and writing about polar bears being like man, and moving between forms. And, you know, we find this in so many cultures, no matter which bear species it is, no matter which part of the world, there's this belief that like humans and bears are very closely related. I think part of that, I don't know if you remember, like the bear's footprint looks a lot like a human footprint. Bears can walk on their hind legs. There's something about them that I think we see ourselves in, which kind of makes us, and the curiosity too, right? Like bears are playful, they're curious. That's why we see videos of them go viral all the time, right? You know, you see bear cubs playing in a pool or playing on a hammock, and like people love, can't get enough of those videos. At the same time, I think humans are fascinated by anything that has the propensity or potential to kill us. And I think bears kind of perfectly encapsulate this dichotomy between like they're so cute and they're also so scary. And that for me, I think is part of like what I've always been drawn to with bears is like that dual nature of these animals, which you can go one avenue with the stories that you tell about them, or you can go the other avenue. And you never really know what to expect when you encounter a bear, right? On the one hand, they're the most terrifying thing that you can imagine in the woods. And then on the other hand, if they don't attack you, it's a really special, magical, cute moment. So I think like there's not many other animals, crocodiles, sharks, you know, things that we feel the same way about like we do with bears.
Yeah, I think yeah, I very well said. Although I think crocodiles, I think I draw the line there. I'm not a fan. I don't want to get anywhere near a crocodile.
Not a fan at all.
No.
And I think too, like, I mean, this was also something that I will say I really appreciated in reporting the book, which was like that my understanding and definition of like bear human relationships was a little bit narrow because it was generally tied to the North American species, which are more likely to kill someone. But we don't see that with pandas, with spectacled bears, with sun bears, right? Like there can be attacks on humans, but it's a completely different ball game compared to those other species. Again, sloth bears, as we've seen in Japan, Asiatic black bears apparently too, like yes, they can be very aggressive, but there are some bear species that don't fit that same characterization.
Yeah, I think I found like in my conversations with like different bear people, you just find out like you can't put bears in like a neat little box. Like, you can't say they're this one thing. And each bear is, when you talk about what a bear is, not just a bear, right? It's many different things to many different people there, yeah, like you say. Yeah. So this I appreciate you might not be able to answer this question, but like did your sort of I did allude earlier saying like you mentioned polar bears being kind of one of your favorite species. Did that change at all over the writing of the book? Like one species kind of drew you in more, or you kind of like, I mean, they're all great, obviously, so.
I'm so sick of them all now. No. I think a lot more about spectacled bears than I did before. And I think that they're like becoming more popular as well. I get so many, I mean, maybe it's my algorithm now is like always giving me spectacled bear things, but I think, Paddington has made them more popular. I think like there's been a lot of research that's been done and funded partially through National Geographic on spectacled bears in recent years. I was so enamored with the cloud forest that I think that I like often like, oh, like how can I get back to that ecosystem to report and work? So yeah, but I think like no, I think people actually do ask me quite a bit like if I'm tired of bears, and my response to that is that I have at least like six more bear stories that I'm writing right now. So apparently the answer is no. I think too, like when you're a journalist, you kind of should choose your specialty carefully because if you write a book about something, that's probably going to lead to more work on that topic. So if you choose something that you don't actually like that much, you might spend the next 5 to 10 years being a bit sick of it and a bit bored. And fortunately with bears, like I think maybe there was like a 6 month period where I was like, okay, I'm gonna write some different things now. But I'm fairly happily back on the bear wagon at this point. And yeah, I think also being in Asia is an interesting. I'm just looking, I'm like, oh, I have my little Taiwanese black bear
Oh,
right here,
fun. Yeah, very nice.
It's always interesting to see like the different cultural interactions. I mean, Taiwan is a place that we haven't talked about. Didn't go there for the book, but like in Taiwan, the black Asiatic black bear, the moon bear, is kind of like what the panda is to mainland China, right? Like it's a whole culture that's very much bears are everywhere in the iconography. So that was quite fun to travel there and see like, oh, everything, everywhere I go is bears. Yeah, I'm not sick of it yet, and I would like to do more bear things.
Oh, great. Is that the Formosan bear? Is that what they call it there in Taiwan? Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, of
So
course.
yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, and obviously in Malaysia right now, sun bears are like the mascot of the tourist board or whatever at the minute.
Yes, I noticed that too. Like sometimes I'll whenever I get to an airport, I'm always like, do they have bears in the airport? And like, yes, in Kuala Lumpur they did.
Yeah. Don't worry. If I don't see a bear, a bear thing somewhere, someone will point it out to me generally whenever I'm out and about. So yeah, can't miss them. That's great. This is a question from Madison, actually, my friend who enjoyed your book as well. She was kind of like, what is something you wish that all people knew about bears?
I think something that I appreciated learning a lot, and I think more people should know, is how intelligent bears are. And that's kind of the response I always give. But when I began reporting that section of the book, it was kind of a, I mean, I'd seen these bears in Vietnam, and I was kind of like, I hope they're not that smart because being that aware of your existence would be pretty bad. And then perhaps in kind of a sad way, the more that I spoke with scientists who are looking at ursine cognition, it was like, oh, actually, they are extremely smart. They are better than great apes at like many, many tasks. They've passed a lot of tests that researchers have given to them that like other species, big cats, apes can't pass. So yeah, I think just a deeper appreciation for like the inner lives, perhaps, of bears would be beneficial for people to know.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, yeah, they're all we I feel like I say it all the time. It's like they're all individuals with their own sort of needs and wants, and their life is important, like if not to anyone else but to them. So yeah. And so after writing the book, so what do you think, what's your kind of outlook on the future of bears? Like some species are obviously in a better position than others, putting it lightly. But like what are your thoughts there?
At the end of the book, I kind of talked about like the three species that I thought would persist that were doing well or like had enough investment in them to kind of continue on. And I think, that's kind of the panda. I mean, not that many, but China will not let the panda go extinct. The American black bear and the brown bear, because they're so prolific globally. And then for the other five species, I was, I guess, more reserved, more worried. I'd say that that's probably worsened in the last few years, just given that we've seen the world kind of seemingly give up and pull back from conservation, especially climate action. So for those species that are threatened by climate change, I mean, we've kind of moved almost completely off the radar at this point, given other crises going on. I think for so many animals and not just bears, like we're kind of within a pretty narrow window of action on a lot of issues and, you know, habitat loss, plastics, pollution, poaching, trafficking, climate change. There's so many species that are kind of down below that 10,000 mark, 10,000 individuals. And yeah, unfortunately, I don't think that we've seen the world coming together. We've been, you know, divided by wars, by politics, distracted by a lot of things. So, yeah, at this point, I think it still relies on those like few people who are kind of the champions of each species. And obviously, each country, you know, they have their own politics going on at home, and maybe there's some efforts that can be made there with habitat protection on the ground. But again, like if we kind of lose sight of the climate element, then a lot of these species face a pretty difficult future.
Yeah. So I suppose like yeah, time will tell. But I mean hopefully after this some people will go out and get the re get your book, appreciate the bears a bit more. But so
Vote for your elected officials who are pro bear conservation.
indeed. So like what is it you're working on now? Like are you working like actually sorry, wait, I've just thought of something. There was one I meant to ask before we get there. Were there any juicy things that you had to leave out of the book? Any sort of juicy bits you could tell us?
That's a good question. The answer would be yes, but now it's been a long time and it's hard to remember them. I mean, I think one of the hardest parts was there were a lot of scientists and people that I met with and interviewed or even traveled with that didn't make it into the book just because if we didn't see a bear, if something didn't happen or it was repetitious of something else, then it was like the editor was going to cut it. So that happened a few times and I still feel always very sad about that. I had a great time near Quito looking for bears in the Paramo in that area, which did not ultimately make it into the book. I had some stories about tracking different bears early in my career that was cut. But a lot of those stories too have made it into the world in a different format, which is nice. Like you can kind of publish things separately as like an essay or like snippets and excerpts. So by and large, I've kind of made up, I think, for most of the things that I didn't get to or cut. Yeah, with the exception of maybe the sun bear so far.
Don't worry, I'll be
But
looking
yeah,
out.
to that end too, like I'd wanted to go to Romania as well to report on what's happening with brown bears, and that also impacted by COVID. So something that I'm working on right now is a feature about brown bears in Romania that's coming out this fall. Working on a feature about black bears in Japan right now, which come out again later this summer. So yeah, there's other things that are still happening in the bear world in my life.
Oh, good. And have you actually been out to Japan to do any research there or for that?
Not yet. The plan is to try to get there in the next few months. Yeah,
Okay.
things can
Yeah.
take a while to come together.
No,
I
that's
think we talked
fair.
about that before.
I think we did, yeah, off mic. But it'll be interesting to see what you find because I know that the way it's kind of being reported is interesting because I find like it feels like it's being reported as this new phenomenon that's just happened, but it's something that kind of st is stretching back to you know, 20 years, and it's just obviously it's becoming more of it's
Been building.
yeah so yeah that'll be interesting to see what you come out with. I'll be looking out for it. Thinking of Japan, I was watching, have you ever seen the film Seven Samurai?
I've not.
Oh well, great, should watch it. I mean it was re it's been remade loads, like you know it was remade into like the Magnificent Seven as a Western, and it's been readapted several times I think. But there's a quote, of course it all comes back to bears. I'm sitting there and the so A Bug's Life is very much the same similar plot where you know they have to go out to find like they have to basically there's a village and they go out to find some samurai to help defend them from some marauders, and the villagers at the start are talking and they go, oh, how will we find them, we don't have any money, we can't pay them, and one of them goes, find a hungry samurai, even bears come down from the mountains when they are hungry. And I thought, I was like, even back then they sort of knew.
They knew it was gonna what was coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting. Like, I mean, there have still been so many bear incidences already this year too, once again. If we're like selling like bear insurance now, you can have like bear shelters at your home, like emergency things that you climb into if a bear comes. So yeah, I think like, I mean, I think very attuned to like what's happening with bears because I have like a alert set up for any time a bear gets mentioned in the media. But it is interesting to see these like trends and see what's happening around the world with bears. I don't think, you know, they're not going away. So
No, and what
lots
is it?
more stories to tell.
Yeah, and any interesting things you've alerted to recently? Just out of curiosity.
Well, I saw that four people were rescued by helicopter after approaching a bear on a trail in Japan recently. So that
Oh,
was something that I thought was quite interesting.
why were they doing
And if,
that? Why were they? Okay.
I'm not, I think they were just afraid. They saw the bear while they were hiking, and they were, I mean, everyone in Japan seems to be like extremely terrified of bears now after what's happened. So people are having really strong reactions to any time they see a bear. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens this fall. And if it's a repeat of last year. So, what else have I seen with bears lately? Those are the main ones, I think. I've been following the Japan bear stuff.
And I suppose if people want to find out more, or see some of your articles, or where's the best place to purchase your book from, like you got any would you like to plug?
They can go to my website, which is gloriadickey.com. You can follow me on Instagram, Gloria Dickey as well. All of the links to my book, the other bear media coverage are all in there.
Cool. I'll put that in the show notes as well. Oh, it's brilliant. I mean, anything else you care to mention?
What have I not talked about? It's like one thing that we've seen as like a big backlash against bear conservation in the United States, especially like what's happening in Alaska, and kind of this like predator control programs, bears that are being shot from helicopters to control their numbers. I think there's been like a big backslide in the past. I mean, it's been going on probably for 5 or 6 years now, but that's something a lot of people are talking about is what's been happening with the government. I mean, it's not just bears, it's wolves as well. But that's so what got a lot of people upset. So yeah, that would be one issue to raise attention to that perhaps people can make a difference with voting. Yeah, that's probably the main one.
Yeah,
Panda
sure. It's
diplomacy is
a
kind of ticking along.
yeah. Are there any
Yeah, I haven't
if
seen.
you're if I was gonna say if you're able to share any links to articles about that as well, I can include that in the show notes.
Sure, I can pass that along.
That'd be thank you.
Great.
So I'd be interested to see that. Oh, thanks very much, Gloria. I think that's been I've really enjoyed our chat. I really
Me
appreciated your
too.
time. I'm thrilled that you came on. Thanks once again to Gloria for taking the time to chat with us. I would recommend her book, Eight Bears, to anyone who has even a passing interest in learning more about bears. You won't regret it. And it's worth keeping in mind that we have to champion these species and their habitats if we want to keep them around. So, go bears! So I think that's all we've got time for now. So as ever, thanks for listening. I'm Philip Stubley, and this is the Bear Den, signing off. See you later. The Bear Den, the American Bear Association podcast, was written and presented by me, Philip Stubley. The music was composed by React Music. Thank you to everyone who has helped make this podcast possible, including Karen Hausman, Bill Lee, Clary Lee, Stephanie Horner, Donna Brazinka, Ross Coyer, and Angie Page. You can find out more about the American Bear Association at americanbear.org. You can find Vinshuti Wildlife Sanctuary on Facebook and Instagram. You can ask questions and submit comments about the podcast to pstubley@americanbear.org. The ABA is a special circumstance. We do not condone feeding wild animals. If you enjoy this podcast, help support the ABA either by donating, becoming an ABA member, symbolically adopting a bear, or come visit the sanctuary during the season and say hello. And if you do enjoy this, please do us a favour. It'll barely take you a minute. On whatever platform you're listening to this on, please either follow us or click the bell for updates and notifications. Please share with family and friends and rate the podcast, as it all helps us grow and is greatly appreciated.